morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Michelle Graves Warren was a longtime federal employee and an African-American secretary who was employed by the Food and Drug Administration. One of the principal issues in this appeal is the shriveled banana hanging, swinging from a noose made from a rubber band that was on her boss's door several feet away from where she worked. She saw the black banana as discriminatory and an effort at intimidating her. She thought that would be her because she'd filed an EEO complaint. We submit the exclusion of the black banana evidence as reversible error. The rules of evidence tilt in favor of the admissibility of evidence in close cases. The magistrate judge understated the probative value of the black banana, and the magistrate judge is required to view the evidence in a light most favorable to the proponent of the evidence, given that the evidence is maximum probative force and its minimum reasonable prejudicial value. The trial court erred in failing to appreciate just how relevant the black banana was. Secondly, there's an issue as to whether or not the magistrate judge even did the proper Rule 403 analysis. She did not, in her ruling from the bench, indicate that she was looking as to whether or not the probative value of the black banana was substantially outweighed by the confusion or the possible prejudicial value. And ultimately, she excluded the black banana on the basis of the fact that she thought it was confusing. We submit that she erroneously made that calculation. There's no reason why the black banana or the introduction of the black banana trial would be confusing to the jury. We submit that the evidence was therefore erroneously excluded, and was erroneously excluded because of errors of law made by the magistrate judge. And we submit under Judge Rogers' decision and Ashcraft that the exclusion of the black banana was prejudicial error.
How do you connect the black banana to Dr. Bailey?
Well, the black banana is connected principally to Mr. Decker because it was on his door. We thought...
Let's assume the worst about Mr. Decker.
We argued that it was the presence of the black banana is related to Bailey's credibility, but our argument in terms of...
So how does that argument run?
Well, it's based on this court's decision in Griffin, Your Honor, that the decision to suspend Michelle Graves Warren was a decision in which Mr. Decker played a substantial role, and even though Mr. Bailey was the final decision maker, the motive, the intent of Mr. Decker is...
The specific thing I saw, argument I saw you making was that... Mr. Decker bullied him by saying it's Warren or me. But is there any reason to think that Mr. Decker's services were so extraordinarily valuable that this was a very compelling threat?
Decker was, I think, a very highly regarded employee at the Food and Drug Administration in this office. And, number one, by filing the complaint and getting the disciplinary process started, that Decker's fingerprints are on the, on the action that was taken against Ms. Graves Warren. And under the cat's paw theory, or under this circuit's analysis in Griffin, it's a jury question as to whether or not what role Decker played in making the in determining the outcome of the disciplinary decision.
Well, there's testimony, however, as to how that disciplinary decision was made. And obviously, Decker was involved to the extent he was one of the parties to the incident. But Mr. Dennis testified as to why he recommended it, and then what he relied on in making that recommendation. And then you have Mrs. Sanders, and you have, I think it's Dr. Bailey. And where do you have, in other words, what I need to understand is if an incident like this happens and the agency wants to investigate it, where it sets up an independent investigation, how else can an agency decide what to do other than as they did it in this instance?
Well, that's what they did. They did an investigation, and Michelle Graves Warren submitted a lengthy statement. The investigator told her he wasn't going to include it. And ultimately, it comes down to a question of credibility and whether or not Graves Warren's telling the truth about what happened or whether or not Decker's telling the truth. And if Decker's not telling the truth, then the next step in the jury's analysis should be whether he did so intentionally for retaliatory or discriminatory actions. But ultimately, the decision made by Dr. Dennis and ultimately the discipline imposed by Dr. Bailey turn on issues of whom do they believe. Either they believe Decker or they believe Graves Warren, and in this case, they decided that they believed Decker. And our argument is that Bailey's analysis was affected, or the jury could find that Dr. Bailey's analysis about imposing the discipline was affected by the fact that the charging party, if you like, Mr. Decker, threatened to, that if she came back, that he was out of there, he was going to leave. So he has an impact, he has a role in shaping the final disciplinary decision that was made by his first line supervisor.
How do you deal with the Hall case in which we upheld summary judgment even though the person accused of retaliation communicated to the final decision maker what he believed the facts were? In that case, we nonetheless held that the final decision maker was independent because there was no evidence that he wasn't, even though the person who was assumed to be a retaliator did communicate the information. Why is this any different?
I think it's controlled by the standard in Griffin, where Dr. Bailey testified at Griffin versus Convention Center, that Dr. Bailey testified that, in fact, he knew that Mr. Decker said, it's her or me. And so that shows his input, his impact on the decision-making process. But it also turns upon the fact that the decision-makers made a credibility determination as to whom they believe. And so, I don't believe.
Right, but they always make a decision. Making a credibility determination about who they believe is always going to occur. That doesn't mean that they have retaliatory intent because they, in the end, believe one side over the other. And that's exactly what happened in Hall, and Hall's interpreting Griffith. So I'm still not seeing the distinction.
Well, the distinction that we argue is that when Decker says it's her or me, that he's putting his thumb on the scales to have an impact on the outcome of the disciplinary process. And further, we argue that the disciplinary process was skewed because the investigator testified or acknowledged that he had this long statement. He refused to take the statement, and his report is filled with his opinion. The agency claims that it was a fair and impartial investigation. I think a reasonable jury could find that the fix was in, and that they brought this high-powered criminal investigator in to do this investigation, and he decided in the beginning and conducted his investigation in such a way as to skew the outcome in favor of Decker against Michelle Graves Warren, based in large part upon his initial determination of the credibility assessment. And otherwise, the agency would be in a position to always be able to say, it couldn't have been discriminatory because the final decision maker didn't have that discriminatory animus. And that's where we go back to Griffin, where the supervisor's comments, for example, on evaluations. He said that, the plaintiff appellant was not performing satisfactorily. That tainted ultimately the decision to terminate Griffin. And similarly, in the Cat's Paw line of cases, mostly out of the Seventh Circuit, if there's an argument, if there's evidence to support the claim that the supervisor is using the disciplinary process and manipulating the process in such a way that the outcome is predetermined, then there's a jury question as to whether or not there was a discriminatory intent or discriminatory animus. The case is also about the assignment to the former storage supply closet. The appellant seemed, or the agency seems to concede the dismal state of the closet. It was filthy, There was a problem with a lock when Grace Moore worked in there and the door was closed. She was imprisoned. She was isolated.
Actually, I didn't understand what was said about that. She couldn't get out?
She couldn't, yes, Your Honor. She couldn't.
Assistance of someone else?
Yes, Your Honor. She couldn't get out. And so as a result of that, she kept the door open, had to keep the door open all the time. And because she had to keep the door open all the time, she was on display for the people walking by who were laughing at her. And she got so upset that ultimately her hair fell out.
Could I ask you about the him or me, her or me point? The case that went to trial was on the suspension, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But the her or me point was that they couldn't work together anymore, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not either you believe me and you suspend her or I leave. It's we both can't work together, with which both sides agreed that they couldn't work together, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I'm not seeing the value of the threat as influencing the disciplinary process.
Well, what he's saying is that she can't come back and you've got to do something about
it. She can't come back to work. I'm looking at the page, which is J1281. She couldn't come back to her old position. But that's not what you were complaining about in the trial. The trial was about the suspension, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's not the same thing.
That's right, Rob. But it shows that sort of animus, and ultimately there's that credibility determination.
It definitely shows the animus. The question is, did it? What you're trying to use it for is to show that he tainted the disciplinary process.
Yes, he did. He tainted he started the process, and by starting the process and by insisting that he hadn't done the things that got Michelle Grace Warren upset enough to call the Federal Protective Service, he in effect determined the outcome of the disciplinary process.
Thank you.
To go back, Your Honor, to your question about the office space that went out on a motion to dismiss, the argument was that it was not an adverse action that made by the government. That's the argument that the Food and Drug Administration made, and that was the basis of the decision. Since that time, we've had Rochon, we've had White versus Burlington Northern, and the idea of what's an adverse action has therefore changed, especially in a retaliation case. And under the law, if the adverse action or the action could be adverse for the purposes of a Title VII claim, if it might well have dissuaded a reasonable worker from making or supporting a charge of discrimination, we would suggest under these circumstances that this formulation creates a jury question as to whether or not the assignment of Graves Warren to the closet was actually adverse for the purposes of the retaliation case, and that's an issue that should have been decided by the jury rather than as a matter of law on motions. And in that regard, talking about just how bad the condition of the office was, the Food and Drug Administration claims in their brief at page 32 that introduction of evidence of the circumstances, the condition of the supply closet would be prejudicial, and it seems to me that that's perhaps a tacit acknowledgement that the conditions in the office were certainly bad enough that a reasonable jury could find that it was an adverse action for the retaliation part of her claim under Title VII.
Sir Carl, when was she moved to the closet?
She was moved to the closet. She was on administrative leave for approximately 3 days following the incident. She was then moved to the closet, so this would be sometime around the 20th of September of 1999, and she stayed there through.
The district court got the date wrong, is that right?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
It was in April 2000, I think.
But and she came back. She was released from the closet in April 2000.
I see. But the actual relocation of the closet was in September.
Yes, Your Honor. I have a very short period of time. I'd like to reserve it for my...
The magistrate's memorandum decision refers to plaintiff's opposition and exhibits 4 and 8. And just where are those exhibits? That's on the exhaustion question.
I believe those are on the exhaustion.
Yeah.
I believe those are the declarations, Your Honor.
Where are they in the joint appendix?
I'll pull the page if I can have 30 seconds or a brief period of time.
They're not described here as declarations. One is described as the August 12, 1999 letter, the one that doesn't show who it's addressed to or so says the magistrate, and the other is an EEO counseling report.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I'll have to check and see where the report is.
Why don't you reserve? All right, we'll hear from
Thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. Alan Birch on behalf of the United States. I'd like to first move to the Rule 50 decision and Graves Warren's positing of the cat's paw theory. Judge Garland, you're completely correct. You stole my thunder on the opening argument that I was going to make. The threat to quit was, first of all, you would need to read the testimony on 1281 in the light most favorable to the plaintiff to come to the conclusion that it was a threat to quit the agency. He said, I didn't want to return to work, which is somewhat open-ended. But in any of the more important point is that it was that he needed to be moved away from her. And there's a clear agreement between Mr. Decker and the plaintiff that they needed to be separated. And indeed, the testimony continues on 1282. That Bailey's reaction to that was he agreed to move them. And so he separated them, and this happened, as we now know, in September of 1999, which is many, many months before the decision to suspend her, the decision that was made by Dr. Bailey. So the evidentiary value of this as a cat's paw theory is essentially nil and vastly insufficient to sustain a jury finding on that theory. The only other evidence that they point out in their briefs is simply the lack of other disciplinary actions, and that has no racial connotation, especially on the evidence in this record. So there's literally no evidence supporting this cat's paw theory. Moreover, on oral argument, Mr. Carl referred to an investigator refusing to take a plaintiff's statement. I didn't see that argument in the brief. Maybe I missed it, but it sounds like a new argument to me. So I just don't see any evidence that would contradict the district court's finding on the Rule 50 motion. There are numerous other links that are missing as well. I'd be happy to talk about those, but I suppose it's probably more interesting to move on to the black banana. The theory for how this infected the retaliation claim, the weakest but critical link is described at the reply brief on page 7, and the banana is, quote, is evidence that Decker was motivated to pressure Bailey to take retaliatory disciplinary action against Graves Warren. Now, how a banana stands for pressure that a manager is going to put on his boss is certainly lost on me, and I don't think there's any evidence in the record to support this inference. I believe we argued down below it was quite a stretch for the banana to have even any racial connotation, but for it to have any sort of connotation of management pressure on a superior, it frankly is nonsense. The evidence is also clear that the primary reason for Dr. Bailey's suspending of Graves One was her false accusation of a physical assault. He did, but it is clear from the transcript that the primary reason was the false accusation of assault. The testimony goes on at great length about the importance of the policy of physical against workplace violence and the importance of taking action against false accusations on that policy. It's also clear that
your position is that even if she introduced evidence sufficient to rebut the other two reasons, that would stand as sufficient to affirm?
I believe so, Your Honor. But you don't need to reach that point in light of the lack of other evidence of any kind of the retaliatory animus getting to the decision maker. With respect to the other issues in this case, there's the office relocation. One of the key points here is that She didn't complain about the office relocation until February 15th of 2000, so any claim that she might have had about that would certainly not go back any farther than January 1st. The evidence that she has that the office was filthy and had a lock that locked her in, at that point, that would be several months old at that point, and there's no evidence in the record that the janitorial staff was excluded from the office or that she made requests to have the office cleaned or the door fixed, and these requests were rebuffed. There's no evidence that she actually was locked in the office, only that under her theory. It was a storage center and or copy center. So it was presumably large enough to hold copying machines. Keep in mind, I mean, the context, I think, should be fairly well implicit that, you know, offices don't grow on trees, and if someone requests to be moved at a moment's notice, there are limited choices.
Isn't that a jury question? She described this as a very bad place. She described it as a place that locked her in. Maybe you don't think so, but a reasonable jury could think so, don't you think?
In terms of the condition of the office, on the evidence here, that's probably true, Your Honor. Do keep in mind that she also claims that she was forced to keep the door open and that she doesn't describe any incidents of actually being locked in. And it also bears noting the comparison to her old office, which was not an office, it was a cubicle. Again, there's simply no evidence to support the... But there's no evidence that it affected her ability to do work, that it was too small to perform the necessary
functions. Well, it could be retaliatory whether it affects her ability to do work. That's the point of Burlington, isn't it?
Yes, that's true, Your Honor. But she, you know, she did also, but as we argue in the brief, the evidence that she put forth just simply doesn't rise to the level of something that would dissuade a reasonable person from going back and filing a second EEO complaint. Indeed, it bears noting that she, you know, did go ahead and file another complaint, although I would agree that that's probably not a relevant way of looking at Burlington Northern, because you don't want to put someone in a situation of being damned if you do and damned if you don't. The only other issue I see is the dismissal of the claims that came before January 1st, 2000 on exhaustion grounds. And there I submit that the paper evidence is very clear. You just need only look to the exhibits to the defendant's motion to dismiss, which appear at R59, exhibits 4 and 7, which are the respective written complaints that describe when she went to the various when she went to the office to make the complaints and what those complaints consisted of, and the dates are very clear therein. If there are no other questions, I request that the judgment be affirmed below.
Counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. To go back to Judge Williams' question, no, the exhaustion or the administrative documents relating to the EEOC complaint that Graves Warren filed is not part of the appendix. I believe the record cite that Mr. Birch gave you is correct. One thing for the court to keep in mind is that this was all decided on a motion to dismiss as essentially a preliminary matter, and there's a very fairly limited record on the condition of the closet. But if you look back at the administrative, the counselor's report, which is one of the exhibits to the defendant's motion to dismiss or for summary judgment, Grace Warren raised the black banana as an issue with the counselor. That part is fairly clear. Now, in terms of the meaning of the black banana, we'd submit that's a jury question. And similarly, with respect to the condition of the closet on a fully developed record, you know, we think that a reasonable jury could find that that was an adverse action taken against Graves Warren. Going back to the assault issue, ultimately it's a question of, was it a false accusation of assault or was it not? And you know, in view of the fact that Gray's Warren says that her relationship with Decker deteriorated after she filed that first complaint in July of 1999, that I think a reasonable jury could find that, in fact, you know, Decker was really annoyed at her, and he came in and got in her space and committed what was Gray's Warren believed was tantamount to an assault against her. And, you know, because of his anger, his animus of by being accused of discrimination, I think the events are all tied together and that a jury ought to be able to hear this as certainly as part of the background. But finally, the black banana comes on the door.
On your theory, any time there's let's call it a racially charged or actually charged in any way with any of the discrimination statutes, dispute between two employees, you're really saying that an agency, there's no way the agency can resolve that without risking a jury trial.
I'm not going that far. I think under these circumstances here where the investigator rejected one of Gray's Warren's statements.
The investigator's got to reject. Oh, I said the statement.
And so what came before the decision maker was not a complete record and not a fair process. And the overwhelming theme, if you like, is that Decker was right, he was fully justified, and Gray's Warren wasn't. And I don't think they can make that sort of determination on this type of record.
Your opposing counsel said that the argument about not taking the statement wasn't in the brief. What is it in the brief?
It's not specifically in as a separate issue in the brief. We argue that the statement shouldn't come in, and, you know, I cross-examined him about, you know, cross-examined the investigator at trial about.
I'm sorry, about the investigator refusing to take her statement?
No, it is not. It's not listed as a separate item in the brief. No, it's part of the examination of the witness, and that was just another reason we'd submit why the brief itself was not, why the investigatory report was not reliable, and why it should not have been admitted.
Is it enough if it's just not reliable? Don't you have to show that the investigator was infected by some animus? I mean, it may not have been a fair process, but that's not what statute is about. Statute is about whether it's a discriminatory process.
Well, our argument is that it was tainted by Decker starting the whole process under the circumstances that occurred here, and that the agency.
That's, as I say, is always going to be true. Somebody's got to start it if it rises to the level of a dispute that the agency resolves, right?
Somebody always has to start it. Yes, Your Honor. If there are no more questions, thank you.
Thank you. Take the case under.